Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nathan White with the group Restore the Fourth, who discusses the significance of a close vote in the U.S. House of Representatives on a measure to halt funding for NSA Dragnet surveillance of Americans' phone communications. Steve Norris, the initiator of the 2013 Walk for Our Grandchildren, who talks about his group's recent civil disobedience action in Washington, D.C., delivering an urgent message to the president and the country, keep fossil fuels in the ground. And Myrna Perez with the Brennan Center for Justice, who examines the Justice Department's new challenge to restrictive voting laws being implemented in states across the country after the Supreme Court gutted the 1965 Voting Rights Act. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
European intelligence agencies are raising a red flag over the possible blowback of al-Qaeda-linked foreign fighters battling to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad in Syria. A top Spanish intelligence official told ProPublica the global jihad has prioritized the Syrian conflict as the principal front. What worries some European officials is that the jihadists' experience in Syria could serve as preparation and training to return to European nations and carry out attacks at home. In the last year, French intelligence identified 130 French Islamists who went to Syria as foreign fighters, nearly triple the number of French nationals who went to fight in Afghanistan from 2001 to 2010. Foreign Islamic fighters are growing in influence among Syrian rebels, factions of which are backed by the European Union and the U.S. While the embattled al-Assad regime can count on support from Russia, Iran, and the Hezbollah militia in Lebanon. Foreign fighters now make up 10% of rebel combatants in Syria, where the United Nations estimates over 100,000 people have been killed and more than 1.7 million have become refugees in the civil war that began in March 2011. Three immigrant rights activists traveled across the border to Mexico and re-entered the United States border in a quest for humanitarian parole or asylum. The three activists, who migrated from Mexico as children with their parents, grew up in the U.S. as undocumented immigrants. Now they seek to expose the Obama administration's deportation policy that has expelled 400,000 undocumented immigrants in 2011. One of the activists, Lisbeth Mateo, put plans for law school on hold to engage in the cross-border protest organized by the National Immigrant Youth Alliance. A total of 9 activists crossed the border at Nogales, Arizona, wearing graduation caps and gowns. They applied for humanitarian parole and were sent to a detention center in Elroy, Arizona, where they began a hunger strike after being denied access to phone calls. Many observers give the activists little chance of winning political asylum, a process that can take up to a decade. The tactics used by the Dream 9 activists, as they are called, are seen as risky, possibly jeopardizing their future status in the U.S. But some young activists have praised the Dream 9 protest as one of the most important, radical, and powerful direct actions in immigration activism history. Along a dark commercial strip outside San Diego, a team of U.S. Marshals and a state labor investigator arrested local restaurateur David Dolan as he left his hotel in April. Along with his son, Dolan owned the State Street Grill, a target of a long-running wage theft investigation. Wage investigator Craig Estep examined the conduct of Dolan's restaurant for a year, documenting hundreds of thousands of dollars in unpaid wages to workers. The two Dolans were charged with various crimes, including grand theft of labor. Wage investigations are not usually associated with big busts, but that is changing in California, where wage violations by employers are a major priority for State Labor Commissioner Julie Sue, who has revamped the state's Department of Industrial Relations Wage Enforcement Unit over the last 2 years. As a result, the state has increased payment of back wages and overtime to workers by 500%. Sue told the news magazine In These Times, employers who break the law have learned the chances of getting caught are slim. She said, "It's my job to change that calculus." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
In a surprise to many inside the Beltway politicians and media pundits, legislation that would have defunded the National Security Agency's program that collects massive amounts of data on U.S. citizens' phone communications narrowly lost in the U.S. House of Representatives by only 12 votes on July 24th. This despite bipartisan opposition to the measure by the Obama administration and both Republican and Democratic Party leaders. The amendment to the annual Pentagon Appropriations Bill, sponsored by Michigan GOP Representative Justin Amash and co-sponsored by his Michigan Democratic colleague John Conyers, was defeated by a vote of 205 in support and 217 opposed. The close vote came despite an aggressive lobbying campaign by the Obama White House and top intelligence officials, who declared that the government's dragnet surveillance of Americans' communications have thwarted an unspecified number of terrorist attacks since September 11, 2001. The House vote is the latest indication that the revelations made to the press by former NSA contract employee Edward Snowden about the U.S. government's previously unknown massive collection of domestic and overseas phone and internet records has eroded public support for those programs. Your reporter spoke with Nathan White, national spokesperson with the group Restore the Fourth, that seeks to raise awareness of unconstitutional surveillance. Here he discusses the significance of the narrow defeat of the Amash Amendment and why he believes citizen pressure will eventually prevail in reforming the government's surveillance programs.
In the years that I've been watching Congress, this is one of the most surprising things that I have ever seen happen. The amendment that was put forth, as you said, by Congressman Amash of Michigan, was not expected to be accepted. At the last minute, John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, allowed the amendment to be incorporated into a very large spending bill that would have funded basically the Department of Defense. It was unexpected that this amendment would even be allowed because John Boehner himself was against it. But because there was so much pressure within his party, he allowed the vote to take place. That in of itself was surprising, but it just gets more surprising from there. The announcement was made at about 9 o'clock, I think it was on a Tuesday. Within an hour, the head of the NSA, General Keith Alexander, announced that the very next day he would go to Capitol Hill. He cleared his schedule, went to Capitol Hill for 4 hours to hold two-hour briefings with member of Congress, confidential, classified, member-only briefings to personally lobby on behalf of these programs. The GOP went into overdrive, whipping their members, saying, do not vote for this. They offered a distraction amendment, which allows members to claim that they're voting to rein in the NSA, but it's written in a way that it actually doesn't change any of the practices. That was the Nugent Amendment. The White House issued a strong statement saying that this was a terrible idea, it was rash, and it would harm national security. Leader Pelosi had a personal vendetta, whipping Democrats and progressives on this issue. Seven chairmen of the GOP sent out a letter saying this would harm national security. You must stand with leadership. Eight members of the former members of the intelligence community who led spy agencies said, we absolutely must not do this. And after all of that, the vote was 217 to 205. It was 12 votes. Seven members of Congress could have flipped this with all that pressure. And what's even more surprising, it was very bipartisan. It was members of both parties in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And when you get bipartisan action, that's nearly a miracle on any issue, let alone something as controversial as national security and government spying.
Nathan White, what comes next here? I've read reports that Republican Representative Jim Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin and Democratic Representative Zoe Lofgren of California are working on a new initiative to change how this country surveils our communication system. And I'm wondering, what have you heard about what they're working on? And does it go far enough?
Sure. Well, what you just said is actually incredibly important. And let me inform your listeners. Congressman Sensenbrenner, who is a Republican from Wisconsin, is actually very widely credited with being the author of the Patriot Act. As I said, most of the pieces of the Patriot Act existed before 9/11, but he is the one who was shepherding the Patriot Act from conception to law, and the three times it's been reauthorized, he's shepherded through the congressional system. In a hearing last week where the legal counsel for the NSA and the legal counsel for the Department of Justice were testifying before his committee, actually a different congressman, he's on that committee, he's not the chairman of that committee, sorry for that confusion, he specifically said to the NSA, I did not mean for the programs to be enacted the way you have enacted them, and if you continue them under this circumstances, I cannot get these programs reauthorized in 2015, which goes to show even the person who's credited with writing this thinks this has gone too far and is now proposing legislation to rein it in. I do think that there's a lot of reason to be optimistic that the system is working, that after a long time, the pendulum is starting to swing back the other way, and over the long course of history, the American Constitution will hopefully be saved. However, that's only going to happen as long as people continue the pressure that Congress has responded to in the last 2 months. Towards that end, my group, Restore the Fourth, is planning our next day of action on August 4th. We're calling it 1984 Day in reference to the George Orwell novel 1984, in which a suspicious government spies on its citizens. And as a result, there's self-censorship to control the people and control their very thoughts. The vote last Wednesday was incredibly promising and very heartening to people like me who have been following this for a long time. But it's not done yet, and we need to keep working to make sure that we do get our members of Congress to be responsive, to continue to be responsive to the American people.
That was Nathan White, national spokesperson with the group Restore the Fourth. Find more information on the group's upcoming 1984 National Day of Protest by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In late July, during what is statistically the hottest 2 weeks of the year in the U.S., the group 350.org's Summer Heat series of protest actions drew attention to climate change and the growing demand for government and industry to implement regulations to combat it. One of the affiliated actions was the 2013 Walk for Our Grandchildren, in which dozens of elders, as well as teens and some middle-aged activists, walked up to 100 miles from Camp David, Maryland, the presidential retreat named for President Eisenhower's grandson, to Washington, D.C. Other members joined 35 miles down the road at Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, to highlight their fight for liberation from fossil fuels, just as abolitionist John Brown's attack on the federal arsenal there highlighted the fight against slavery. Once in Washington, 54 marchers were arrested on July 26 in an act of nonviolent civil disobedience inside the building that houses the offices of Environmental Resources Management, or ERM, a consulting company that wrote the draft environmental impact statement for the proposed Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. ERM concluded in the report that construction of the Keystone pipeline would not exacerbate climate change, a conclusion with which protesters passionately disagreed. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who participated in the protest and was one of those arrested, interviewed Steve Norris, the initiator of the 2013 Walk for Our Grandchildren, who was also among those arrested at ERM. Here he explains the origin of the name of the protest walk, why the group targeted ERM, and what the future may hold for climate change action.
I actually think it was a very good idea, even though there was some controversy at the beginning. I think we named it that because those of us who actually came together to create an organization to make this happen, we were all elders or grandparents, and so we had that energy. Some other people questioned whether that was appropriate because we always wanted to include younger people, and it was kind of hard just in that messaging to know whether the people would feel welcome or not. So there was quite a bit of discussion with different organizations whether that was appropriate language, and it turned out, I think, that it was, and young people have felt very included. And one young woman who's 19 walked because she's got a 10-year-old brother that she's concerned about. So all these ages kind of play into this. And my sense, and this is pure intuition, nobody said it quite this way, but my sense is that they feel an extra dose of love that we, the elders at our age and so on, are as committed to trying to deal with this crisis as we are and willing to put ourselves out the way we did on this walk, where we were walking at times in 100-degree heat. I think that communicates something to them, that presence or kind of typical grandparent-y kind of actions don't communicate.
So just describe a little bit the target of the civil disobedience protest at the end of the walk and how you picked that target.
Yeah. As you know, about 60 of us went into the office building, which a group called ERM, Environmental Resource Management. We went there because ERM is the company that the Department of State hired to do environmental impact report about the environmental impacts of the Keystone XL pipeline. ERM wrote this report and made the argument that the tar sands extraction in Alberta and the Keystone XL pipeline, which would transport that oil to Texas, that it would not make any difference in the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, which is patently absurd. You know, you can't take lots and lots of tar sands oil out of the ground and not contribute to global warming. They made the argument on the basis of the analysis that carrying the tar sands oil by rail would be no more expensive than doing it by a pipeline, and therefore the oil is going to get to Houston one way or the other, so the pipeline makes no difference. It turns out that that's wrong, that the numbers they used to do that were completely fudged, that it's actually four times more expensive than what the environmental impact report said, and it's also documented in the Washington Post and Bloomberg News. Both have reported that the ERM certified in its environmental impact report that it had no conflicts of interest. In other words, had done no business with TransCanada, the organization that's building the pipeline, or with some of the fossil fuel companies that are operating in Alberta. That they said, we don't do business with these people. And it turns out, if you go to their website, they advertise that they have done it. And why they got away with this, why the State Department didn't do kind of very basic research to find out that, we don't know, except that there's equal corruption in the State Department around some of this stuff.
Obama might nix the pipeline, but even if he does, that's not the end of the struggle. Right. On the front of your T-shirt says, walk for our grandchildren, and the back says, keep fossil fuels in the ground. So what's the next step for you or for this, I don't know if it's really an organization, this group of people who are very committed to attacking climate change?
You know, I don't know, and I've been sort of, as this walk is coming towards its end, I've been asking myself that question, and I don't know the answer to that yet. My best guess is, and I've been an activist for many years, you know, and that you figure things out in a creative fashion as you go along, and every stage is different. We've done this walk. This walk has been really important, I think, to us personally and may have some impact on public policy. We will see that in the future. But the next action will be different. What that is at this stage, I don't know. I need to go home and rest a little bit and have conversations with people. The idea of involving elders and grandparents and children and so on in the way we have is clearly inspiring and clearly has caught people's attention, and even President Obama now is talking about, he made a speech in Berlin, I guess, in early June, in which he said, my job is to protect future generations from climate change. So even he's getting the message. That message is really, really important. So we need to figure out other ways of communicating that message, of communicating it to the public. We will win this, you know. We don't know when, but there will come, and I really like the idea of a tipping point, where this whole fossil fuel regime that's running the world to some extent, we're going to turn it over.
That was Steve Norris, initiator of the 2013 Walk for Our Grandchildren. Protesters arrested were charged with illegal entry, a misdemeanor, and must appear in court in Washington, D.C. in August. Learn more about the nation's climate change protest network by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After the Supreme Court's controversial and narrow June 25th 5-4 ruling overturning a key section of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, states across the country that had been prevented from implementing restrictive voter ID laws, reduced early voting schedules, and limiting voter registration moved quickly to revive those once outlawed measures. States moving to enforce these laws recently blocked for their discriminatory effect include Texas, North Carolina, Alabama, and Mississippi, which had long been subject to the Voting Rights Act's preclearance provisions for their documented history of election regulations that disenfranchised minority voters. But Attorney General Eric Holder told members of the Urban League on July 25th that the Obama administration's Justice Department would exercise provisions of the Voting Rights Act left intact by the Supreme Court to challenge a new Texas voter identification law and other similar discriminatory laws in other states. The Department of Justice will use Section 2, which blocks bias practices, and Section 3, a little-used provision of the Civil Rights Era Act that permits federal courts to enforce pre-approval measures for voting changes in states and jurisdictions that engage in blatant discrimination. Apart from the recent Department of Justice action against Texas, civil rights activists are demanding that Congress work toward a more permanent solution by quickly replacing the Voting Rights Act Section 4, struck down by the Supreme Court, which was a formula for designating jurisdictions subject to preclearance scrutiny. Your reporter spoke with Myrna Perez, Deputy Director of the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program. Here she examines the Justice Department's challenge to restrictive voting laws being implemented in states like Texas and what's at stake for democracy in restoring the Voting Rights Act.
It cannot be overstated how serious the decision of the Supreme Court was in Shelby County. It was a humongous decision that's going to have a terrible impact for voters, and we are not going to know the impact, the full impact, until some time has passed. But there's a couple of things we do know already. One, states that were deterred from enacting problematic legislation now feel free to move forward. There was much news about the North Carolina restrictions that were passed, and there were legislators on the record saying that at first the bill was just going to be a photo ID bill, but now that they don't have to worry about Section 5, they're going to put other stuff in it, and that they did. It cuts back the days of early voting. It makes it impossible for 16 and 17-year-olds who were allowed to pre-register before they turned 18 from doing so. It also does things like eliminate Election Day registration, among other things. We also saw states that were not submitting their changes for preclearance, like Alabama, who passed a proof of citizenship law but wasn't putting that forward to get evaluated to see if it was going to be discriminatory. They have indicated that they're moving forward on that one. Texas announced within 2 hours of the Supreme Court decision that it was going to enact its photo identification law, which a three-judge court had already said was going to have negative and deleterious effect on communities of color in Texas. And I think this is just the beginning. Thankfully, only one of the states that was covered under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act has active legislatures, and that was North Carolina. But we're worried that when those legislatures resume, we're going to see a lot more restrictive laws being considered, debated, and enacted. And without Section 5 there to block the implementation of these, voters are going to be with far fewer protections than they had before the Shelby County decision.
Myrna Perez, Attorney General Eric Holder at the Department of Justice has announced that he's going to be trying to preempt some of these laws from going into effect by using Section 3 of the Voting Rights Act, which is still intact now. But there's not a lot of history of the Justice Department using that, as I understand it, to try and short-circuit some of these restrictive voting laws put in by states.
You are right on all accounts. So for your listeners, Section 3 is a seldomly used provision of the Voting Rights Act whereby a court could target a specific jurisdiction for being subject to the preclearance requirement. It becomes into effect when a court reaches a determination that voters' 14th or 15th Amendment rights were violated, which is different than the standard for preclearance, which in addition to looking at whether or not someone intentionally discriminated against someone. We'll look at whether or not someone had the effect of discriminating against a community of color. And because Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was used so plentifully and so effectively, these other provisions weren't being employed. They didn't make sense. They're much more cumbersome. They're done on a case-by-case basis. They happen after the fact. They're far less effective than Section 5 is, but now that Section 5 is no longer available, voters and their advocates and the Department of Justice are going to need to look at other tools like Section 3. And it's very clear that the Justice Department has indicated a ready willingness to do so.
Myrna Perez, I wanted to ask you about what Congress can do and will do in the wake of the overturning of the key provision in the Voting Rights Act of 1965, given that it wasn't all that many years ago that Congress did almost unanimously recertify the Voting Rights Act.
That's exactly right. In 2006, Congress voted to continue the Voting Rights Act for another 25 years. It was nearly unanimous in both sides of the legislature. And it was done after careful study and deliberation where they heard from scores of witnesses, had tons of hearings, and looked at literally 15,000 pages of documents. And the Supreme Court decision, as devastating as it will be, did invite Congress to revisit the Voting Rights Act and did explain that the Voting Rights Act, the strongest and most robust parts of the Voting Rights Act, were still constitutional. We just needed to figure out how to appropriately subject a jurisdiction to its requirements. And so what Congress should do is start building the legislative record again. It needs to make sure that we have a transparent and bipartisan process whereby experts, voters, communities, advocates, academics, legislators are all able to share our experiences about what it means to be a voter and how it is that we need to best protect our voters from racial discrimination, to roll up their sleeves and get to work on it. Because right now, every day that we don't have a functioning Section 5 is a day that a voter could be vulnerable.
That was Myrna Perez, Deputy Director of the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program at New York University School of Law. For more news and commentary on restoration of the Voting Rights Act and discriminatory voter suppression tactics, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.